Other times he helps Inch hurt people.
Jeremias was having trouble.
Sometimes the priest takes people away with him. Takes them when he goes. They don't come back.
He fought to catch his breath.
And there's other things. Other things down there. Terrible things. Oh, God, please don't send me back.
He grasped Rachel's wrist with his hand.
Please hide me.
Rachel tried to mask her shock. She deliberately closed off her thoughts about Simon and this new revelation until she could consider it all in privacy. But despite her firm self-control, Rachel felt a cold hatred running through her, a hatred unlike anything she had ever felt.
"We won't let them have you," she said.
Her straightforward tone made it clear that any gainsaying of her will would bring great risk to the gainsayer.
"Will?"
She broke off for a moment, nonplussed.
What would they do? They could not hide the boy for long here in the servants' quarters, especially if he had run away from the king's forges below the hayholt.
What other things were there?
Jael asked. Her brown, calf-like eyes were puzzled.
Hush now,
Rachel said sharply, but Jeremias was already answering.
I don't know, he said. There are shadows that move. Shadows without people. And things that are there. And then they aren't. And voices.
He shivered, and his eyes stared past the candle flame to the darkness in the room's corner.
Voices that cry and sing and...
Tears formed in his eyes once more.
That's enough,
Rachel said sternly, displeased with herself for letting the boy talk so long. Her charges darted glances among themselves, nervous as startled sheep.
Elysia, she thought, that's all I need, to have the last of my girls frightened out of the castle. Too much talking, she said aloud. The boy needs rest. He's so worn and beaten, he has the vapors. Let him sleep.
Jeremiah shook his head weakly.
I'm telling the truth, he said. Don't let them have me. We won't, Rachel said. Go to sleep. If we can't hide you, we'll think of some way to get you out of the hayholt. You can go to your kin, wherever they may be. We'll keep you away from that one-eyed devil, Inch. And Priorities,
Jeremiah said slurredly, succumbing to drowsiness.
He talks to the voices.
A moment later the boy was slumbering. A little of the fear seemed to lift from his hunger-thinned features. Rachel looked down at him and felt her heart grown hard as a stone in her breast.
That devil priest Priorates, that murderer, what kind of plague had he brought down on their house? What foulness to her beloved hayholt?
And what had he done to her Simon? She turned to look sternly at her wide-eyed maids.
You had all better get what sleep you can, she growled. A little excitement doesn't mean the floors won't need scrubbing when the sun is up.
As they crawled into their beds, Rachel snuffed the candle, then lay down with her cold thoughts. Outside, the wind was still searching for a way in. The morning sun rose above the grey blanket of clouds. It brought a diffuse light to the rolling grasslands of the high thrivings, but could not lift the damp from the endless leagues of prairie grass and heather. Deonoth was soaked to the thighs and tired of marching. The thrivings men did not stop for a meal, instead eating dried meat and fruits from their saddlebags as they rode. The prisoners were not offered any food, and were only allowed to pause for a short rest at mid-morning, during which time Deonoth and Joshua quietly questioned the rest of their party about Vorsheva's whereabouts. No one had seen her leave, although Jaloe said she... But one of his mounted companions nodded his head and said,
"It is a bad year. Many cows die birthing. Others eat, but do not grow fat."
The thrivings man's beard fluttered in the wind.
It is a bad year, he repeated.
Here and there among the great herd were circles of wagons, each circle surrounded with fences of hastily driven posts. The wagons themselves were all wooden, with large high wheels, but otherwise were quite different from each other. Some were tall as two or three men, wheeled cottages with wooden roofs and shuttered windows. Others were little more than a wagon bed topped with a cloth-covered shelter, the fabric rippling and snapping in the stiff breeze. Children played in many of the enclosures, or darted in and out among the milling, amiable cattle. Horses grazed in some of the paddocks, and not just dray horses and wagon pullers. Many were slender-limbed and wild-maned, with something light and strong as forged steel to be seen in their step, even from a distance.
Ah, God, if only we had a few beasts like those, Deonoth said wistfully. But we have nothing to trade. I am mightily tired of walking.
Joshua looked at him with a trace of sour humor.
We will be lucky if we walk away from here with our lives, Deonoth. And you are hoping for a brace of battle steeds?
I would rather I had your optimism than their horses.
As the prisoners and their captors continued south, the sprawl of separate wagon camps began to come together, clumped like mushrooms after an autumn rain. Other groups of mounted men rode in and out among the settlements. Joshua's escorts exchanged shouted remarks with some of them. Soon the wagons stood so near each other that it began to seem that the prisoners traversed a city without roads. At last they reached a large stockade, its fence posts hung with ornaments of bright metal and polished wood that clattered in the wind. Most of the riders sheered off, but Hotvig, the leader, and six or seven others ushered the prince's party through a swinging gate. There were several compounds within the stockade, one of them containing a score of fine horses, another a half dozen fat and glossy heifers. In an enclosure by himself stood a huge stallion, his shaggy mane twined with red and gold ribbons. The great horse nosed the ground as they passed and did not look up. He was a monarch, more used to being stared at than staring. The men escorting Joshua's party touched their hands to their eyes reverently as they passed.
It is their clan beast, Chiloe said, to no one in particular.
At the far end of the encampment stood a great wagon with wide, heavy-spoked wheels and a banner bearing a golden horse billowing from the roof peak. Before it were two figures, a large man and a young girl. The girl was knotting the man's long beard into two thick braids that hung down onto his chest. Despite his age, he looked to have passed some 60 summers on the grasslands. His black hair was only faintly striped with silver, and his wide frame was still knotted with muscle. He held a bowl upon his lap in his huge, beringed and braceleted hands. The rider stopped and dismounted. Hotvig strode forward to stand before him.
We have captured several trespassers who walked the Fellowelt without your leave, Marchthane. Six men, two women, and a child.
The Marchthane stared the prisoners up and down, his face split in a wide, crooked-toothed grin.
Prince Joshua Lackhand, he said without the least trace of surprise in his voice. Now that your stone house is fallen, have you come to live beneath the sky like men do?
He took a long swallow from his bowl, draining it dry, then handed it to the girl and waved her away. For Colmich, Joshua said, bleakly amused.
So you are Marchthane now.
When the choosing came, of all the chieftains there was only Blavement, who would stand against me. I broke his head like an egg.
Fekolmich laughed, patting at his new braided beard, then stopped, lowering his eyebrows like a nettled bull.
Where is my daughter?
If that young one was yours, you just sent her away, Joshua said. Fekolmich clenched a fist in anger, then laughed again.
Stupid tricks, Joshua. You know who I mean. Where is she?
I will tell you the truth, Joshua said. I do not know where Vosheva is. The Marchthane looked him over speculatively.
So, he said at last, you are not so high in the world today, Stone Dweller. You are a trespasser in the Free Thrivings now, as well as a daughter stealer. Perhaps you will seem better to me with your other hand cut off, too. I will think on it.
He lifted his hairy paw and gestured carelessly to Hotvig.
Put them in one of the bull runs until I decide which ones to cut up and which to keep.
Merciful Hayden preserve us, Father Strangyard murmured.
The March Thane chuckled, flicking a wind-blown curl of hair from his eye.
And give these city rats a blanket or two, and some food, Hotvig. Otherwise, the night air may kill them and rob my sport.
As Joshua and the others were led away at spearpoint, Fikornij turned and shouted for the girl to bring him more wine. Chapter 14. A Crown of Fire. It was a dream, Simon knew, even as he dreamed it. It started in an ordinary enough fashion. He was lying in the Hayholt's great loft, hidden in tickling hay, watching the familiar figures of Shem Horsegroom and Castlesmith Reuben the Bear, talking quietly below. Reuben, his broad arms glimmering with sweat, was hammering clankingly away at a scarlet-hot horseshoe. Suddenly the dream took on a strange cast. Reuben's and Shem's voices changed, until they sounded nothing like their real selves. Simon could now hear the conversation perfectly well, but the smith's hammer was silent as it struck the gleaming iron.
But I have done all you asked for,
Shem abruptly said in a queer, rasping tone.
I brought King Elias to you.
You presume too much, Reuben replied.
His voice was like nothing Simon had ever heard, cold and remote as the wind in a high mountain pass.
You know nothing of what we want, of what he wants.
There was more wrong with the blacksmith than just his voice. A feeling of wrongness emanated from him, a black and bottomless lake hidden beneath a crust of thin ice. How could Reuben seem so evil, even in a dream? Kind, slow-talking Reuben? Shem's lined face smiled cheerfully, but his words sounded strained.
I do not care. I will do anything he wishes. I ask little in return.
You ask a great deal more than any other mortal would, Reuben replied. Not only do you dare to call on the Red Hand, you have the temerity to demand favors.
He was chill and uncaring as graveyard dirt.
You do not even know what you ask. You are a child, priest, and you grasp at gleaming things because they seem pretty. You may cut yourself on something jagged and find that you bleed to death.
I don't care,
Shem spoke with a lunatic firmness.
I don't care. Teach me the words of changing. The Dark One owes me. He is obligated.
Reuben threw back his head in wild laughter. A crown of flames seemed to blaze about his head.
Obligated,
he gasped. The sound of his amusement was terrifying.
Our master? To you?
He laughed again, and suddenly the blacksmith's skin began blistering. Little gouts of smoke jetted into the air, as Reuben's flesh burned away, peeling back to reveal a shifting kernel of flame beneath, pulsating with reddish light, like a coal fanned by wind.
You will live to see his final triumph. That is more reward than most mortals can expect.
Please!
Even as Reuben flared, Shem had begun to shrink, becoming small and grey as a charred parchment. His tiny arm waved, crumbling.
Please, undying one, please!
His voice was oddly light, fraught with a kind of slyness.
I will ask nothing further. I will not speak of the Dark One again. Forgive a mortal fool. Teach me the word.
Where Reuben had stood, a living flame glowed.
Very well, priest. There is, perhaps, little risk in giving you this dangerous but final toy. The Lord of All will be taking this world back soon enough. There is nothing you can do that he cannot make undone. Very well. I will teach you the word, but the pain will be great. No change is without some cost.
Laughter bubbled again in the unearthly voice.
You will scream.
I don't care,
Shem said, his ashy form swirling away now into darkness, as did the shadowed smithy and then the hayloft itself.
I don't care. I must. No.
Finally, even the glowing thing that had been Reuben became only a bright point in the blackness. A star. Simon awakened, breathless as a drowning man, his heart thudding in his chest. There was a single star overhead, peeping through the hole in the top of their sleeping shelter like a blue-white eye. He gasped. Binnebik lifted his head from Kantaka's shaggy neck. The troll was half asleep, but struggling toward full wakefulness.
What is wrong, Simon?
He asked.
Were you having a dream that frightened?
Simon shook his head. The tide of fear was ebbing a little, but he was sure it had been more than just a night fantasy. It had seemed that an actual conversation was taking place nearby. A conversation that his sleeping mind had woven neatly into the stuff of his dream. A mundane happening that he had experienced many times. What was strange and frightening was that there were no other speakers anywhere about. Sludig was snoring. Binnebik obviously knew wakened.
It's nothing, Simon said, struggling to speak evenly.
He crawled to the front of their lean-to, mindful of the bruises from the evening's stave practice, and pushed his head out to look around. The first star he had seen had a great deal of company, a spatter of tiny white lights across the night sky. The clouds had been driven away by the brisk wind. The night was clear and cold, and the unrelieved monotony of the white waste stretched away on every side. There was not another living thing to be seen anywhere beneath the ivory moon. So it had only been a dream. A dream of how old Shem Horsegroom might speak with Prirati's croaking tongue, and how Reuben the Bear might speak with the sepulchral tones of nothing on God's living earth.
Simon?
Binnebik asked sleepily.
Are you?
He was frightened. But if he was to be a man, he could not run to cry on someone's shoulder every time he had a bad dream.
It's nothing.
He crawled shivering back to his cloak.
I'm well.
But it seemed so real. The branches of their flimsy shelter creaked, wind-handled.
So real, like they were talking in my head.
Taking the Silver Sparrow's fragmentary message to heart, they rode from first light to last every day, trying to outpace the coming storm. Simon's mock combats with Sludig now took place by firelight, so that he had scarcely a moment to spend alone from the moment he rose until he tumbled into exhausted sleep at the end of each day. The days of riding passed in a procession of sameness, the endless hunt fields of white, the dark tangles of stunted trees, the numbing insistence of the wind. Simon was grateful for his thickening beard. Without it, he often thought, the relentless wind might rub away his face, down to the very bones. It seemed that the wind had already worn away the face of the land, leaving behind little that was remarkable or distinct. Had it not been for the widening line of forest on the horizon, he could have supposed that every morning found them back at the same cold, bleak starting place. Thinking morosely about his own warm bed in the hayholt, He decided that even if the Storm King himself were to move into the castle, his minions numerous as snowflakes, Simon could still live happily in the servants' quarters. He wanted a home desperately. He was close to the point where he would take a mattress in hell, if the devil would lend him a pillow. As days wore by, the storm continued to grow behind them, a black pillar rising ominously in the northwestern sky. Great cloudy arms clutched the firmament like the branches of a heaven-spanning tree. Lightning flickered between them. "It's not moving very fast," Simon said one day, as they ate a sparse noontime meal. There was more nervousness in his voice than he would have liked. Binnebik nodded.
"It grows, but its spreading is slow. That is something for being thankful about."
He wore an unusually dispirited expression.
"The slower it is moving, the longer we are not beneath it. For I am thinking that when it comes, it will bring a darkness with it that will not be passing away. As with storms of the ordinary type."
"What do you mean?" Now the tremor was plain to hear.
"It is not a storm with just snow and rain," Binnebik said carefully. "My thought is that it is exactly meant to bring fear where it goes. It rises from storm spike. It has the look of something full of unnaturalness."
He raised his palms apologetically.
"It is spreading, but as you said, not with great swiftness."
"I know about such things," Sludig said, "but I must admit I'm happy we will be off the waste soon. I wouldn't want to get caught in the open in any storm, and that one looks truly nasty."
He turned toward the south and squinted.
2 days until we reach Eldeorte," he said. "That will be some protection."
Binnebik sighed.
"I hope you are right, but I am fearing that there will be no protection against this storm. Or that the protection must be something other than forest trees or roofs."
"Do you mean the swords?" Simon asked quietly. The little man shrugged.
"Perhaps. If we are finding all three, perhaps winter can be kept at spear length, or even pushed back. But first, we must go to where Jaloi tells us. Otherwise it is only worrying about things we cannot be changing. That is foolishness."
He mustered a smile.
"When your teeth are gone, we can look, say, learn to like marsh."
The next morning, their seventh on the waste, came laden with foul weather. Although the storm in the north was still only an inky blotch defacing the far horizon, steely grey clouds had gathered overhead, their edges stripped into sooty tatters by the rising wind. By noon, when the sun had vanished from view entirely behind the dismal pall, the snow began to fly.
"This is terrible," Simon shouted,
eyes narrowed against the stinging sleet. Despite his heavy leather gloves, his fingers were swiftly growing numb.
"We're blinded. Shouldn't we stop and make shelter?"
Binnebik, a small snow-covered shadow atop Kantaka's back, turned and called back to him.
"If we go a little farther, we will reach the crossroads."
"Crossroads," Sludig bellowed. "In this wilderness?"
"Ride nearer," Binnebik cried. "I will be explaining."
Simon and the Rimmer's man brought their mounts closer to the striding wolf. Binnebik lifted his hand to his mouth, but still the wind's roar threatened to carry off his words.
"Not far beyond here, I am thinking, this old Tomate Road meets the White Way that is running along the northern edge of the forest. At the crossroad may be shelter, or at least the trees should be of more thickness there, closer to the woods. Let us go riding on a while longer. If there is nothing in that spot, we will make our camp there despite it.
As long as we stop well before dark, Troll, Sludic bellowed. You are clever, but your cleverness may not be enough to make a decent camp in darkness in this blizzard. Having lived through all the madness I have seen, I do not want to die in the snow, like a lost cow.
Simon said nothing, saving his strength so he could more fully appreciate his misery.
Aiden, it was cold. Would there never be an end to snow?
They rode on through the bleak, icy afternoon. Simon's mare plodded slowly, ankling through the new drifts. Simon leaned his head close to her mane, trying to stay out of the wind. The world seemed as formless and white as the inside of a flower cask, and only slightly more habitable. The sun was quite invisible, but a dimming of the already scarce light suggested that the afternoon was fading fast. Binnabik, however, did not seem inclined to stop. As they passed yet one more unprepossessing stand of evergreens, Simon could stand it no longer.
I'm freezing, Binnabik, he shouted angrily above the wind. And it's getting dark. There's another bunch of trees gone and we're still riding. Well, it's almost night, by God's bloody tree. I'm not going to go any farther. Simon,
Binnabik began, striving to assume a placating tone while yelling at the top of his lungs.
There's something in the road, Sludic cried hoarsely. Vaya! Something ahead! A troll!
Binnabik squinted.
It is being no such thing, he shouted indignantly. No Cannock would be foolish enough to go wandering alone in such weather.
Simon stared into the swirling grey dimness before them.
I don't see anything, as neither do I.
Binnabik brushed snow from his hood lining.
I saw something, Sludic growled. I may be snow-blinded, but I am not mad.
An animal, that is most likely, the troll said. Or, if we are unlucky, one of the diggers as a scout. Perhaps it is time to make shelter and fire, as you said, Simon. There is a stand of trees that looks to make better sheltering just ahead. There, over the rise.
The companions chose the most protected spot they could find. Simon and Sludig wove branches among the tree trunks for a windbreak, while Binnabik, with the help of his yellow fire powder, set flame to damp wood and began to boil water for broth. The weather was so unremittingly foul and cold that after sharing the thin soup, they all curled up in their cloaks and lay shivering. The wind was too loud for any but shouted conversation. Despite the proximity of his friends, Simon was alone with his cheerless thoughts until sleep came. Simon woke with Kantaka's steaming breath on his face. The wolf whined and nudged him with her great head, rolling him halfway over. He sat up, blinking in the weak rays of morning sun filtering into the copse. Snowdrifts had piled against the woven branches, making a wall that kept the wind at bay. So the smoke from Binnabik's campfire rose almost undisturbed.
Good morning, Simon friend, Binnabik said. We have survived through the storm.
Simon gently pushed Kantaka's head out of his side. She made a noise of frustration, then backed away. Her muzzle was red-daubed.
She has been unsettled all the morning, Binnabik laughed. I am thinking that the many frozen squirrels and birds and such who have tumbled from the trees have fed her well, however.
Where's Sludic?
He is seeing to the horses.
Binnabik poked at the fire.
I convinced him to take them down slope in the open, so the horses would not be stepping on my morning meal or your face.
He lifted a bowl.
This is the last of the broth. Since our dried meat is now almost finished, I suggest you enjoy it. Meals may be scarce if our own hunting must be relied on.
Simon shivered as he wiped a handful of snow on his face. But won't we reach the forest soon? Pinnebik patiently offered the bowl again.
Just so. But we will be traveling along it rather than through. It is a route more circuitous, but less time-consuming, since we will not be cutting through underbrush. Also, in this frozen summer, there may be few animals who are not sleeping in their dens and nests. Thus, if you are not soon taking the soup from my hands, I will drink it myself. I am no more interested in starving than you, as well as a great deal more sensible.
Sorry. Thank you. Simon hunched over the bowl, enjoying a deep breath of the rising scent before he drank.
You may be washing the bowl when you have finished, the troll sniffed. A nice bowl is a luxurious thing to have on a journey of such dangerousness.
Simon smiled. You sound like Rachel the dragon.
I have not met this dragon Rachel,
Binnebik said as he stood up, brushing snow from his breeches.
But if she was given charge of you, she must have been a person of great patientness and kindness.
Simon chortled. They reached the crossroads in late morning. The meeting of the two roads was marked only by a gaunt finger of stone set upright in the frozen ground. Grey-green lichen, seemingly impervious to frost, clung to it grimly.
The old Tomate Road runs through the forest.
Binnebik gestured to the barely distinguishable path of the south road, which coiled away through a stand of firs.
Since I am thinking it is never more used, and likely quite overgrown, we should instead follow the White Way. Perhaps we will find some deserted habitations where we may be finding supplies.
The White Way proved a slightly newer road than the one leading from the ancient site of Tumate. There were a few marks of recent human visitation, a rusted and broken iron wheel rim dangling from a roadside branch, where it had doubtless been thrown by an irate wagon owner. A sharpened spoke perhaps used as a tent spike, discarded by the shoulder. A circle of charred stones, half covered in snow.
Who lives out here?
Simon asked. Why is there a road at all?
There were once several small settlements east of St. Scandi's Monastery, Sludic said. You remember Scandi's? The snow-buried place we passed on our way to the Dragon Mountain. There were even a few towns here. Soverbeck, Grinsaby, some others as I remember. I think also that a century or so ago, people traveled this way around the Great Forest when they came north from the Thrithings. So there may have been a few inns.
In days more than a century gone, Binnebik intoned. This part of the world was being much travelled. We Cannock, some of us, that is to say, travelled farther south in summer, sometimes to the edges of the lowlander countries. Also, the city themselves were everywhere in their wandering. It is only in these late and sad days that all this land has become empty of voices.
It does seem empty now, Simon said. It seems like no one could live here anymore. They followed the winding course of the road through the short afternoon. The trees were gradually becoming thicker here at the forest's edge, in spots growing so closely about the road that it seemed as if the companions had already entered Aldeota, whether they wished to or not. At last they came to another standing stone, this one leaning forlornly by the roadside, with no crossing or other possible landmark in sight. Sludig dismounted to take a closer look.
There are runes on it, but faint and weathered.
He peeled back some of the frozen moss.
I think they say that Grinseby is nearby.
He looked up, smiling in his frosty beard.
Some place with a roof or two, perhaps, even if nothing else. That would be a nice change.
His step a little springier, the Rimmersman vaulted back into his saddle. Simon, too, was heartened. Even a deserted town would be a vast improvement over the comfortless waste. The words of Binnebeck's song came back to him.
You have slipped into cold shadows.
He felt a moment's pang of loneliness.
Perhaps the town would not be deserted, after all. Maybe there would be an inn with a fire and food.
As Simon yearned for the comforts of civilization, the sun vanished for good behind the forest. The wind rose, and the early northern twilight came down upon them. There was still light in the sky, but the snowy landscape had turned blue and grey, soaking up shadow like a rag dipped in ink. Simon and his companions were nearly ready to stop and make camp, and were discussing the subject in loud voices over the monotonous wind, when they came upon the first outbuildings of Grinseby. As if to disappoint even Sludig's modest hopes, the roofs of these abandoned cottages had collapsed under the weight of snow. The paddocks and gardens were also long untended, knee-deep in swirling white. Simon had seen so many emptied towns in his northern sojourn that it was hard to believe that the frost march and the waste had once been inhabited, that people had led their lives here, just as they did in the green fields of Erkenland. He ached for his own home, for familiar places and familiar weather. Or had winter already crawled over the entire land? They rode on. Soon Grinseby's deserted houses began to appear in greater profusion on either side of the road Binnebeck had named the White Way. Some still bore traces of their once residence. A rusted axe with a rotted handle standing in a chopping block before a snow-buried front door. An upright broom sticking out of the roadside drifts.
Cold,
the boy said in fair westerling. Sludig looked surprised but smiled and nodded.
Come on then, lad.
He gently took the acorns and poured them into his cloak pocket, then gathered up the unresisting child in his strong arms.
It's all right then. We'll help you.
The Rimmersman placed the dark-haired stranger on the front of his saddle, wrapping his cloak around him so that the boy's head seemed to grow from Sludig's now broad belly.
Can we find a place to make camp now, troll?
He growled. Binnebeck nodded.
Of course.
He urged Kantaka ahead. The boy watched the wolf with wide but unworried eyes as Simon and Sludig spurred after. Snow was rapidly filling in the hollow where the boy had stood. As they rode on through the empty town, Sludig brought out his skin of kangkang and let the newcomer have a short drink. The boy coughed, but otherwise seemed unsurprised by the bitter Cannock liquor. Simon decided he might be older than first appearance made him seem. There was a precision to his movements that made him seem less like a child. Some of his apparent youth, Simon guessed, might be due to his large eyes and slender frame.
What's your name, lad? Sludig asked at last.
The boy looked him over calmly.
Fren,
he said at last, the word fluidly and oddly accented. He tugged at the drinking skin, but Sludig shook his head and put it back in his saddlebag.
Friend?
Simon asked, puzzled.
Fren, I am thinking he said, Binnebeck replied. It is a Harkaman name, and I am thinking he might be a Harka.
Look at that black hair, Sludig said. The color of his skin, too. He is a Harka, or I am no Rimmersman. But what is he doing alone in the snow?
The Harkas Simon knew were a footloose people, accounted good with horses, and skilled in games at which other people lost money. He had seen many at the great market in Urchester.
"Do the Hurkers live out here? In the White Waste?"
Sludig frowned.
"I've never heard of such, but I have seen many things of late I would not have believed in Elvretshale. I thought they lived mainly in the cities and on the grasslands with the Tridings folk."
Binnebeck reached up and patted the boy with a small hand.
"So have I been taught, although there are some who also are living beyond the waste, in the empty steppe lands to the east."
After they had ridden farther, Sludig dismounted again to search for signs of habitation. He returned, shaking his head, and went to Vren. The child's brown eyes gazed unflinchingly back at him.
"Where do you live?" the Rimmer's man asked.
"With Skodi," was the reply. "Is that near?"
Binnebeck asked. The boy shrugged.
"Where are your parents?"
The gesture was repeated. The troll turned to his companions.
"Perhaps Skodi is the name of his mother, or it might be a name of some other town near to Grinsaby village. It is also being possible he has strayed from a caravan of wagons. Although these roads, I have shown us, are not much used at the best of times. How could he survive long in fearful winter days like these?"
He shrugged, a movement oddly similar to the child's.
"Will he stay with us?" Simon asked.
Sludig made an exasperated noise but said nothing. Simon turned on the Rimmersman angrily.
"We can't leave him here to die!"
Binnebeck waved a placating finger.
"No! Do not fear that we would. In any case, I suspect that there must be more people than Vren who are living here."
Sludig stood up.
"The troll is right. There must be folk here. Anyway, the idea of taking a child with us is foolish."
"That is what some were saying of Simon,"
Binnebeck responded quietly.
"But I am having agreement with your first statement. Let us find his home."
"He can ride with me for a while," Simon said. The Rimmersman made a wry face but handed over the unresisting child. Simon wrapped the boy in his cloak as Sludig had done.
"Sleep now, Vren," he whispered.
The wind moaned through the ruined houses.
"You're with friends now. We'll take you home."
The boy stared back at him, solemn as a petty cleric at a public ceremony. A small hand snaked out from beneath the jacket to pat Homefinder's back. With Vren's slender form resting against his chest, Simon took his reins in one hand so he could drape an arm around the boy's midsection. He felt very old and very responsible.
"Will I ever be a father?"
he wondered as they tramped on through the gathering dark.
"Have sons?"
He thought about it for a moment. Daughters? All the people he knew, it seemed, had lost their fathers. Binnebeck's in a snowslide. Prince Joshua's to old age. Jeremias the Chandler's boy, Simon remembered, had lost his to the chest fever. Princess Miriamel's sire might as well be dead. He thought about his own father, drowned before he was born. Were fathers just that way, like cats and dogs, making children and then going away?
"Sludig," he called, "do you have a father?"
The Rimmersman turned, an irritated expression on his face.
"What do you mean by that, boy?"
"I mean, is he alive?"
"For all I know," the Rimmersman snorted. "And little I care, either. The old devil could be in hell, and it would not bother me."
He turned back to the snow-shrouded road.
"I will not be a father like that,"
Simon decided, clutching the child a little closer. Vren moved uneasily beneath Simon's cloak.
"I'll stay with my son. will have a home, and I won't go away. But who would be the mother? A series of confusing images, random as snowflakes, flurried before his mind's eye. Miriamel distant on her tower balcony at the Hayholt, the maid Hepzibah, cross old Rachel, and angry-eyed Lady Vorshaver. And where would his home be? He looked around at the vast whiteness of the waste and the approaching shadow of Aldeorta. How could anyone hope to stay in one place in this mad world? To promise that to a child would be a lie. Home? He would be lucky to find a place to get out of the wind for a night. His unhappy laugh set Vren to squirming. Simon pulled the cloak tighter around them both. As they approached the eastern outskirts of Grinsaby, they still had not seen a living soul. Neither had there been any evidence of recent habitation. They had questioned Vren closely, but had been unable to elicit any information other than the name Skodi. "Is Skodi your father?" Simon asked.
"It is a woman's name," Sludig offered. "A Rimmer's woman's name."
Simon tried again. "Is Skodi your mother?" The boy shook his head. "I live with Skodi," he said, his words so clear, despite the accent, that Simon wondered again if the boy was not older than they had guessed. There were still a few desolate settlements perched among the low hills along the White Way, but they were appearing more and more infrequently. Night had come on, filling the spaces between trees with inky shadows. The company had ridden too long, and too far past eating time by Simon's reckoning. Darkness now made their search impractical. Benevik was just setting a pitchy pine limb alight to use as a torch, when Simon saw a gleam of light through the forest, some distance from the road. "Look there!" he cried. "I think it's a fire!" The distant white blanketed trees seemed to glow redly.
"Skodi's house! Skodi's house!"
the boy said, bouncing so that Simon had to restrain him.
"She'll be happy!"
The company sat for a moment, eyeing the flickering light.
"We go carefully," Sludig said, flexing the fingers that clutched his Cannock spear. "It is a damned odd place to live. We have no assurance these folks will be friendly."
Simon felt a sudden inner chill at Sludig's words. If only Thorn were reliable enough for him to carry it at his side. He felt his bone knife in its scabbard, and was reassured.
"I will ride ahead," Benevik said. "I am smaller, and Kantaka is more quiet. We will go to have a look."
He murmured a word. The wolf slid off the road through the long shadows, her tail waving like a puff of smoke. A few minutes passed. Simon and Sludig rode slowly along the snowy downs, not talking. Staring at the warm light that shimmered in the treetops, Simon had fallen into a sort of shallow dream, when he was startled by the troll's abrupt reappearance. Kantaka grinned hugely, her red tongue hanging from her mouth.
"It is an old abbey, I am thinking," Benevik said,
his face almost hidden in the darkness of his hood.
"There is a bonfire in the dooryard, and several people who are around it. But they look to be children. I was seeing no horses, no sign of anyone waiting to ambush."
They rode quietly forward to the crest of a low hill. The fire burned before them at the bottom of a tree-lined clearing, surrounded by small dancing silhouettes. Behind them loomed the red-tinted stone walls and cracked mortar of the abbey. It was an old building that had suffered beneath the weather's rough handling. The long roof had collapsed in several places, the holes gaping at the stars like mouths. Many of the surrounding trees also seemed to have pushed their limbs right through the small windows, as though trying to escape the cold. As they sat looking, Vren slithered free beneath Simon's arm and hopped down from the saddle, tumbling into the snow. He stood, shaking like a dog, then pelted down the hill toward the bonfire.
Some of the small shapes turned at his approach with glad cries. Vren stood among them for a moment, waving his arms excitedly, then pushed through the Abbey's front door and disappeared into the warm glow. When long moments had passed and no one came back out again, Simon looked inquiringly at Binnebik and Sludig.
"It is certainly seeming to be his home,"
Binnebik said. "Should we go on our way?" Simon asked, hoping they would say no. Sludig looked him over, then grunted in exasperation.
"It would be foolish to pass the chance of a warm night,"
the Rimmer's man said grudgingly.
"And we are ready to make camp. But no word of who we are or what we do. We are soldiers run away from the garrison at Skogi, should any ask."
Binnebik smiled.
"I approve of your logic. Although I am doubting I can be mistaken for a Rimmer's man warrior. Let us go and see Vren's home."
They cantered down into the dell. The small figures, perhaps half a dozen in all, had resumed their dancing game. But as Simon and the others approached, they paused and fell silent. They were only raggedly dressed children, as Binnebik had suggested. All eyes now turned to the new arrivals. Simon felt himself subjected to a thorough scrutiny. The children seemed to range in age from 3 or 4, up to Vren's age, or a little older, and seemed to be of no one type. There was a little girl who shared Vren's black hair and dark eyes, but also 2 or 3 others, so fair they could be nothing but Rimmersgaarders. All wore expressions of wide-eyed caution. As Simon and his friends dismounted, heads turned almost in unison to watch. No one spoke.
"Hello,"
Simon said. The boy nearest him stared sullenly, his face lapped in firelight.
"Is your mother here?"
The boy continued to stare.
"The child we brought went inside," Sludig said. "That is undoubtedly where the grown folk are."
He hefted his spear thoughtfully, and a half dozen pairs of eyes warily followed his movement. The Rimmer's man took the spear with him toward the abbey door, which Vren had swung shut behind him, then propped it against the pitted mortar of the wall. He gave his silent audience a meaningful look.
"No one may touch this," he said. "Understood? Gyal es kunden."
He patted his scabbarded sword, then lifted a fist and thumped on the door. Simon looked back at Thorn, a hide-wrapped bundle on one of the pack horses. He wondered whether he should bring it with him, but decided that would draw more attention than was best. Still, it rankled. So many sacrifices to get the black sword, just to leave it strapped to the saddle like an old broomstick.
"Binnebik," he said quietly, pointing at the concealed sword. "Do you think?"
The troll shook his head.
"Little need for concern, I am certain," the troll whispered. "In any case, even if these children were to steal it, I am guessing they would have a difficult time carrying it away."
The heavy door swung slowly open. Little Vren stood in the doorway.
"Come in, you men. Skodi says, come in."
Binnebik dismounted. Kantaka sniffed the air for a moment, then bounded away in the direction they had come. The children by the fire watched her departure rapidly.
"Let her hunt," Binnebik said. "She is not happy walking inside a people house. Come, Simon, we have been offered some hospitality."
He stepped past Sludig and followed Vren inside. A fire nearly as large as the bonfire in the dooryard was roaring and crackling in the grate, throwing wild, flickering shadows on the cobwebbed plaster. Simon's first impression of the room was of some kind of animal nest. Great piles of clothes and straw and other more unusual articles were piled haphazardly on every dirty surface.
"Welcome, strangers," someone said. "I'm Skodi.
Do you have any food? The children are very hungry.
She was sitting in a chair close to the fire, with several children younger than those in the yard, clambering over her lap or sitting at her feet. Simon's first thought was that she was another child herself, albeit a very large one. But after a moment's inspection, he could see that she was his own age, or even a little older. Her white blonde hair, colourless as spider silk, framed a round face that might have been quite pretty, despite a few blemishes, if she had not been so fat. Her pale blue eyes stared avidly at the new arrivals. Sludig looked at her suspiciously, uncomfortable in such close surroundings.
"Food? We have little, mistress."
He considered for a moment.
"But you are welcome to share."
She waved her hand airily. Her chubby pink arm nearly dislodged a sleeping toddler.
"It's not important. We always get by."
As Sludig had predicted, she spoke Westerling with a heavy Rimmersgaard accent.
"Sit down and tell me the news of the world."
She frowned, pursing her red lips.
"There may be some beer somewhere. You men like beer, don't you? Wren, go find some beer. And where are those oak nuts I sent you for?"
Sludig looked up suddenly.
"Oh."
Sheepishly, he produced Wren's acorns from his cloak pocket.
"Good," Skodi said. "Now beer." "Yes, Skodi."
Wren scuttled off down an aisle of stacked stools, vanishing into the shadows.
"How is it, if we may be asking, that you can live out here?" Binnebik said. "It seems a place of great isolation."
Skodi had been staring at him avidly. Now her eyebrows lifted in surprise.
"I thought you were a child."
She sounded disappointed.
"But you are a little man."
"Kenok, my lady,"
Binnebik sketched a bow.
"What your people call trolls."
"A troll?"
She clapped her hands in excitement. This time one of the children did slither off her rounded lap into the blankets coiled at her feet. The little one did not wake, and another quickly crawled up to take the spot the first had vacated.
"So wonderful! We have never had a troll here."
She turned and called into the darkness.
"Wren, where is the beer for these men?"
"Where did all these children come from?" Simon asked, wonderingly.
"Are they all yours?"
A defensive look came to the girl's face.
"Yes, they are now. The parents did not want them, so Skodi keeps them instead."
"Well," Simon was nonplussed. "Well, that's very kind of you. But how do you feed them? You said they were hungry."
"Yes, it is kind," Skodi said, smiling now. "It is kind of me, but that is how I was taught. Lord Usirius said to shelter the children."
"Aye," Sludig grumbled. "That's so."
Wren came back into the firelight balancing a jar of beer and several cracked bowls. The pile swayed dangerously, but with help he was able to set them down and pour beer for all three travellers. The wind had risen, making the flames billow in the grate.
"This is a very good fire," Sludig said as he wiped froth from his moustache. "You must have had a difficult time finding dry wood in yesterday's storm."
"Oh, Wren chopped for me early in the spring."
She reached out and patted the boy's head with her plump hand.
"He butchers and cooks, too. He is my good boy, Wren is."
"Is there no one here who is older?" Binnebik asked. "I am meaning nothing discourteous, but you seem young to raise these children in solitude."
Skodi looked at him carefully before answering.
"I told you, the mothers and fathers have gone away. There is no one here but us. But we do very well.
don't we, Vren? Yes, Cody.
The little boy's eyes were growing heavy. He snuggled himself against her leg, basking in the warmth of the fire.
So, she said at last, you said that you had some food. Why do you not get it? Then we can share. We can find the makings of a meal somewhere here.
Wake up, Vren, you lazy thing.
She cuffed him lightly on the side of the head.
Wake up! It's time to make supper.
Don't wake him, Simon said, feeling sorry for the little black-haired boy.
We'll take care of the meal. Nonsense, Skodi said.
She gave the protesting Vren a gentle shake.
He loves to make supper. You go and get what you have. You will stay the night, yes? Then you should stable your horses. I think the stable is around the side of the courtyard. Vren, get up, you lazy lump. Where is the stable?
The forest had grown close around the back of the abbey where the stables were located. The old trees, dusted with snow, swayed mournfully as Simon and his companions threw dry straw onto the floor of one of the stalls and dumped snow into the trough to melt. The stable seemed to have been used occasionally. There were blackened torches in the cressets, and the crumbling walls had been haphazardly patched. But it was hard to guess when the most recent occasion might have been.
Shall we bring all our things inside? Simon asked. I am thinking so,
Binnebik replied, loosening the belly strap on one of the pack horses.
I doubt the children would steal anything that was not food. But who can say what might become mislaid?
The smell of wet horses was strong. Simon rubbed Homefinder's hard flank.
Don't you think it's strange that no one lives here but children?
Sludig laughed shortly.
The young woman is older than you, Snowlock, and quite a lot of woman at that. Girls her age often have children of their own.
Simon blushed, but his irritated reply was forestalled by Binnebik.
I am thinking, the troll said, that Simon speaks with good sense. There are things unclear about this place. It will do no harm to ask more questions of our hostess.
Simon wrapped Thorn in his cloak before carrying it back through the snow to the abbey. The changeable sword was at this moment quite light. It also seemed to throb slightly, although Simon knew that might be no more than his chilled, trembling hands. When little Vren let them back inside, Simon placed Thorn near the hearth where they would sleep and piled several of their saddlebags atop it, as though to immobilize a sleeping beast that might wake and flail about. Supper was an odd mixture of unusual food and strange conversation. Beside the remains of dried fruit and meat provided by the three travelers, Skodi and her young charges put out bowls of bitter acorns and sour berries. Scavenging, Vren found a moulding but edible cheese somewhere in the abbey's ruined larder, along with several more jars of musky Rimmersgaard beer. With this, they managed to make a meal that served the whole company, albeit meagerly. The children all assembled numbered a dozen or more. Binnebik found little time to ask questions during the meal. Those of Skodi's charges, who were old enough to go outside, stood up to relate fanciful stories of various adventures they had encountered that day. Stories so exaggerated as to be obviously untrue. One little girl told of flying to the top of a mighty pine tree to steal a feather from a magical jaybird. Another, one of the older boys, swore that he had found a chest of ogre's gold in a cave in the forest. Vren, when his turn came, calmly informed his listeners that while gathering acorns, he had been pursued by an icy demon with glinting blue eyes, and that Simon and his two companions had saved him from the frosty menace's clutches, smiting it with their swords until it shattered into icicles. Skodi held the smaller children on her lap as she ate, each in its turn, and listened to each story with an expression of envious fascination. She rewarded those she enjoyed most by giving the teller an extra morsel of food, which was eagerly accepted. Indeed, Simon decided, the reward was probably the main reason for the fabulous nature of the stories. There was something about Skodi's face Simon found captivating. Despite her great size, there was a delicacy to her girlish features and a brightness to her eyes and smile that transfixed him. At certain moments, as she laughed breathlessly at one of the children's inventions, or turned so that the firelight played glinting in her flaxen hair, she seemed quite beautiful. At others, when she greedily snatched a handful of berries from one of the smaller children and stuffed her wide mouth, or when her spellbound appreciation of the storytelling for a moment resembled mere idiocy, he found her repellent. A few times she caught Simon staring. The glances she returned to him frightened him a little, even as they made him blush. Skodi, for all her bulk, wore a hungering look that would not have been out of place on a starveling beggar.
"So," she said when Vren had finished his wild tale, "you are even braver men than I guessed."
She smiled hugely at Simon.
"We will sleep well tonight, knowing you are under our roof. You do not think Vren's ice demon has brothers, do you?"
"I am thinking it is not likely," Binnabik said with a gentle smile. "You need not be fearing any such demon while we are staying here in your home. In return, we have much gratitude for a roof and a hearth for warming."
"Oh, no," Skodi said, her eyes wide. "It is me who is grateful. We do not get many visitors. Vren, help clear a place for the men to sleep. Vren, do you hear me?"
Vren was staring intently at Simon, an unfathomable expression in his dark eyes.
"Your mentioning of guests, my lady," Binnabik began, "it brings to my mind a question I had meant to be asking you. How is it that you and these children have come to be in such a place of isolation?"
"The storms came. Others ran away. We had nowhere else to go."
Her brisk words poorly concealed her wounded tone. "None of us were wanted. None of the children. Nor Skodi either." The subject discussed, her voice warmed again.
"Now, it is time for the little ones to sleep. Come, all of you. Help me up."
Several of her wards scurried to assist Skodi in levering her large body up out of the chair. As she moved slowly toward the door at the back of the room, a pair of sleeping children clinging to her like baby bats, she called,
"Vren will help you find your way. Bring the candle when you come, Vren."
She disappeared into the shadows. Simon awakened from an uneasy sleep in the depths of night, filled with confused panic by the red-touched and starless darkness, and also by a faint thread of sound that wove itself in and out of the muted tapestry of windsong. It took some moments to remember that they slept near the hearth of the old abbey, warmed by dreaming coals and sheltered from the elements by the roof and decaying walls. The noise was Kantaka's lonely howl, floating distantly. Simon's fear faded a little, but did not disappear.
"Was that a dream I had last night? Shem and Reuben and the voices? Was it truly just a mad fancy? Or was it as real as it seemed, as it sounded?"
Ever since the night of his escape from the Hayholt, he had not felt a master of his own destiny. That same stony night, when he had somehow felt Prirati's repellent thoughts and had unwillingly shared in the ritual as Elias received the terrible gift of the sword, Sorrow, Simon had wondered if he was even a master of his own mind. His dreams had become vivid, far beyond the realms of mere night-wandering. The dream at Jaloi's house, in which a cadaverous Morghenes had warned him of a false messenger, and the repeated visitations of the great all-crushing wheel, and of the tree that was a tower, white among the stars. These seemed too insistent, too powerful to be just unsettled sleep. And now, in his dreams the night before, he heard Priorates talking to some unearthly thing as clearly as if Simon listened at a keyhole. These whispered, a deeper shadow, sensed rather than seen, looming tall and wide above him. She stroked his cheek.
"Just got your beard, too. You are a pretty one. I will keep you."
Simon strove helplessly to wriggle from beneath her touch.
"They don't want you either, do they?"
Skodi said, crooning as though to a baby.
"I can feel it. Skodi knows. Cast out you were. I can hear it in your head. But that is not why I had Vren bring you."
She settled down beside him in the dark, folding into a crouch like a tent, pulling loose from its stakes.
"Skodi knows what you have. I heard it singing in my ears, saw it in my dreams. Lady Silvermask wants it. Her lord Red Eyes does too. They want the sword, the black sword. And when I give it to them, they will be nice to me. They will love Skodi and give her presents."
She caught a lock of his hair between her plump fingers and gave it a sharp pull. The twinge of pain seemed far away. A moment later, as if in recompense, she ran her hand carefully over Simon's head and face.
"Pretty," she said at last. "A friend for me. A friend my age. That is what I have waited for. I will take away those dreams that are bothering you. I will take away all your dreams. I can do that, you know."
She lowered her whispering voice even further, and Simon realized for the first time that the heaving, breathing of his two friends had ceased. He wondered if they were lying silent in the darkness, waiting to save him. If that was so, he prayed they would act soon. His heart seemed as nerveless as his leaden limbs, but fear beat through him, aching like a secret pulse.
"They drove me out of Hastead," Skodi muttered. "My own family and neighbors said I was a witch, said I put curses on people, drove me out."
Horribly, she began to snuffle. When she spoke again, her words were garbled by tears.
"I showed them. When father was drunk and sleeping, I stabbed mother with his knife, and then put it back in his hand. He killed himself."
Her laugh was bitter but remorseless.
"I could always see things others could not, think of things they would not. Then, when the deep winter came and would not go away, I began to be able to do things. Now, I can do things no one else can do."
Her voice rose triumphantly.
"I am growing stronger all the time, stronger and stronger. When I give Lady Silvermask and Lord Red Eyes the sword they're looking for, the singing black sword I heard in my dreams, then I'll be like they are. Then the children and I will make everyone sorry."
As she spoke, she absently slid her cold hand from Simon's forehead down into his shirt, letting it play over his naked chest, as if she petted a dog. The wind had stilled, and in the dreadful silence of its abatement, he suddenly knew that his friends had been taken away. There was no one in the lightless room but Skodi and Simon.
"But
I will keep you, she said. I will keep you for myself.
Chapter 15. Within God's Walls. Father Denevan toyed with his food, staring into his bowl as though some helpful message might be written there, in olive pits and breadcrumbs. Candles burned fiercely the length of the table. Priorati's voice was loud and harsh as a brazen gong.
So, you see your sacredness. All that King Elias wishes is your acceptance of one fact. Mother Church's provenance may be men's souls, but she has no right to interfere in the disposition of men's corporeal forms by their legitimate monarch.
The hairless priest grinned in self-satisfaction. Denevan's heart sank to see the lector smile dully in return. Surely Renesin must know that Elias was as much as declaring that God's shepherd on earth had less right to power than an earthly king. Why did he sit and say nothing? The lector slowly nodded his head. He looked across the table to Priorates, then briefly to Duke Benigaris, new master of Naban, who appeared a trifle nervous beneath the lector's scrutiny, hurriedly wiping grease from his chin with the back of a brocaded sleeve. This feast of Hlafmansa Eve was usually only a religious and ceremonial occasion. Although Denevan knew him to be utterly the creature of Priorates' master Elias, at this moment the Duke seemed to be wishing for more ceremony and less confrontation.
The High King and his emissary Priorates wish only the best for Mother Church, sacredness,
Benigaris said gruffly, unable to hold Renesin's gaze, as though he saw his rumored murder of his father mirrored there.
We should listen to what Priorates says.
He addressed his trencher once more, wherein he found more convivial company.
We are considering all that Priorates has to say,
the lector responded mildly. Silence fell upon the table once more. Fat Villegas and the other escritors present returned to their own meals, obviously pleased that the long-feared confrontation seemed to have been averted. Denevan lowered his eyes to the remains of his supper. A young priest who hovered at his elbow refilled Denevan's goblet with water. It had seemed a good night to avoid wine, and reached forward to take his bowl. But Denevan waved him back. It was better to have something to concentrate on, if only to avoid looking at viperous Priorates, who was not bothering to hide his immense pleasure at discomfiting the church hierarchy. Absently pushing breadcrumbs with his knife, Denevan marveled at how inseparably the great and the mundane were linked. This ultimatum from King Elias and the lector's response might one day seem an event of unforgettable magnitude. Like that day long ago when the third Larexes had declared Lord Sulis heretic and apostate, seeing that magnificent and troubled man into exile. But even during that momentous event, Denevan reflected, there had probably been priests who scratched their noses or stared at the ceiling, or silently bemoaned their aching joints as they sat within the very crucible of history. Even as Denevan now poked at his own supper leavings, and Duke Benigaris belched and loosened his belt. So men always would be, ape and angel mixed, their animal nature chafing at the restraints of civilization, even as they reached for heaven or for hell. It was amusing, really, or should have been. As Ecrator Villegas tried to initiate a more soothing supper-table conversation, Denevan suddenly felt an odd trembling in his fingers. The table was shuddering gently beneath his hands. Earthquake was his first thought. But then the olive pits in his bowl began to slide together, slowly, forming themselves into runes before his astonished eyes. He looked up, startled, but no one else at the banquet table appeared to notice anything amiss. Villegas droned on, his chubby face gleaming with sweat. The other guests watched him, politely feigning interest. Creeping like insects, the leavings in Denevan's bowl had merged to form two sneering words, scroll pig. Sickened, he looked up to meet Priorati's shark black eyes. The alchemist wore a look of vast amusement. One of his white fingers was waving above the tablecloth, as if sketching upon the insubstantial air. Then, as Denevan watched, Priorates waggled all his digits at once. The crumbs and olive stones in Denevan's bowl abruptly tumbled apart. Whatever forces that had bound them now dispersed. Denevan's hand rose defensively to grasp the chain that lay beneath his cassock, feeling for the hidden scroll. Priorates' grin widened in almost childish glee. Denevan found his usual optimism melting before the Red Priest's unmistakable confidence. He suddenly realized what a thin and breakable reed his own life actually was.
"They are not, I suppose, truly dangerous," Veligis was blathering, "but it is a dreadful blow to the dignity of Mother Church. These barbarians setting themselves afire in public squares, a dreadful blow. As much as daring the Church to stop them. It is a kind of contagious madness, I am told, carried by bad airs. I no longer go out without a kerchief to wear over my nose and mouth. But perhaps the fire dancers are not mad,"
Priorates said lightly.
"Perhaps their dreams are more real than you would like to believe." That is,
Veligis spluttered, but Priorates ignored him, his obscenely empty eyes still fixed on Denevan.
"He fears no excess now,"
Denevan thought. The realization seemed an unbearable burden.
"Nothing binds him any longer. His terrible curiosity has become a heatless and insatiable hunger."
Had that been when the world had begun to go wrong? When Denevan and his fellow scroll-bearers had brought Priorates into their secret councils? They had opened their hearts and treasured archives to the young priest, respecting the honed sharpness of Priorates' mind for a long time before the rot at the center of him could no longer be mistaken. They had driven him from their midst then. But too late, it seemed. Far, far too late. Like Denevan, the priest sat at the tables of the mighty. But Priorates' red star was now ascending, while Denevan's track seemed murky and obscured. Was there anything more he could do? He had sent messages to the two scroll-bearers still living, Yarnauga and Uke Cook's apprentice, though he had heard from neither in some time. He had also sent suggestions or instructions to others of good faith, like the forest woman Jaloi and little Tiamak in the marshy Ran. He had brought Princess Miriamel safely to the Sankelen Adonitis and made her tell the story to the lector. He had tended all the trees as Morghenes would have wished. All he could do now was wait and see what fruit might come. Slipping Priorates' troubling gaze, Denevan looked around the lector's dining hall, trying to take note of details. If this was to be a momentous night, for good or ill, he might as well try to remember all he could. Perhaps in some future, a brighter one than he could now envision, he would be an old man standing at the shoulder of some young artisan, offering corrections.
"No, it wasn't like that at all. I was there,"
he smiled, forgetting his worries for a moment. What a happy thought to survive the cares of these dark days, to live with no greater responsibility than being an annoyance to some poor artist, laboring to complete a commission. His moment of reverie ended abruptly, arrested by the sight of a familiar face in the arched doorway that led to the kitchens. What was Cadrach doing here? He had been in the Sankelen Adonitis scarcely a week, and would have no business that could bring him near the lector's private quarters. So he could only be spying on the lector's supper guests. Was it only curiosity? Or was Cadrach, Padraic, feeling the tug of old loyalties, of conflicting loyalties? Even as these thoughts flashed through Denevan's head, the monk's face fell back into the shadows of the door and was gone from sight. A moment later, a server marched through with a wide salver, making it obvious that Cadrach had vanished from the archway entirely. Now, as if in counterpoint to Denevan's confusion, The lector rose suddenly from his tall chair at the head of the table. Renesin's kind face was somber. The shadows thrown by the bright candlelight made him seem ancient and bowed with troubles. He silenced prattling Veligis with a single wave of his hand.
"We have thought," the lector said slowly. His white head seemed remote as a snow-capped mountain. "The world, as you speak of it, Priorates, makes a certain kind of sense. There is weight to its logic. We have heard similar things from Duke Benegaris and his frequent envoy, Count Aspytis."
"Earl Aspytis," Benegaris said abruptly, his heavy face flushed. He had drunk a great deal of the lector's wine. "Earl," he continued heedlessly, "King Elias made him an earl at my request, as a gesture of his friendship to Narban."
Renesin's slender features curled in a poorly concealed look of disgust.
"We know you and the High King are close, Benegaris, and we know that you yourself rule Narban. But you are at our table now, in God's house, my table. And we bid you to remain silent until Mother Church's highest priest finishes speaking."
Dunedain was shocked by the lector's angry tone. Renesin was ordinarily the mildest of men, but found himself heartened by such unexpected strength. Benegaris' mustache quivered angrily, but he reached for his wine cup with the clumsiness of an embarrassed child. Renesin's blue eyes were now fixed on Priorates. He continued in the stately manner he so seldom used, but which seemed so natural when he did.
"As we said, the world which you and Elias and Benegaris preach makes a certain kind of sense. It is a world where alchemists and monarchs decide the fate not only of men's corporeal forms, but of their souls as well. And where the king's minions encourage deluded souls to burn themselves for the glory of false idols, if it suits their purposes. A world where the uncertainty of an invisible god is replaced by the certainty of a black, burning spirit who dwells on this earth, in the heart of a mountain of ice."
Priorates' hairless brow shot up at this. Dunedain felt a moment of cold joy. Good, so the creature could still be surprised.
"Hear me!"
Renesin's voice gained force, so that for a moment it seemed that not only the room had fallen silent, but the whole world with it. As though in that instant the candlelit table rode the very cusp of creation.
"This world, your world, the world you preach to us with your sly words, is not the world of Mother Church. We have long known of a dark angel who strides the earth, whose bleak hand reaches out to trouble all the hearts of Austin Ard. But our scourge is the archfiend himself, the implacable foe of God's light. Whether your ally is truly our enemy of countless millennia, or just another vicious minion of darkness, Mother Church has always stood against his like, and always shall."
Everyone in the room seemed to hold their breath for an endless moment.
"You do not know what you say, old man."
Priorati's voice was a sulphurous hiss.
"You grow feeble, and your mind wanders."
Shockingly, not one of the escritors raised their voices in protest or dissent. They stared, wide-eyed, as Renesin leaned across the table and calmly engaged the priest's angry stare. Light seemed to quail and almost die throughout the banquet hall, leaving only the two illuminated, one scarlet, one white, their shadows stretching, stretching.
"Lies, hatred, and greed," the lector said softly. "They are familiar, age-old enemies. It matters not beneath whose banner they march."
He stood up, a slim, pale shape, and lifted a hand. Dineven felt again the fierce, uncontrollable love that had driven him to bend his back in supplication before the mystery of man's divine purpose, to bind his life over into the service of this humble and wonderful man and to the church that lived in his person. With cold deliberation, Renesin drew the sign of the tree in the air before him. The table seemed to shudder again beneath Dunevan's hand. This time, he could not believe it, the alchemist's doing.
You have opened doors that should have remained closed for all time, Priorates, the lector proclaimed. In your pride and folly, you and the High King have brought a ponderous evil into a world which already groaned beneath a mighty burden of suffering. Our church, my church, will fight you for every soul until the very day of weighing out dawns. I declare you excommunicate, and King Elias with you, and also banish from the arms of Mother Church any who follow you into darkness and error.
His arm swept down once, twice.
Duas omnen podensis, fiat vorem lexeran. Duas omnen podensis, fiat vorem lexeran.
No clap of thunder or horn of judgment followed the lector's booming words. Only the distant peal of the clavian bell tolling the hour. Priorates stood slowly, his face pale as wax, his mouth twisted in a trembling grimace.
You have made a horrible mistake, he rasped. You are a foolish old man, and your great mother church is a child's toy made of parchment and glue.
He was quivering with surprised fury.
We shall put a torch to it ere long. The howling will be great when it burns. You have made a mistake.
He turned and stalked from the dining hall, his boot heels clocking on the tiled floor, his robes billowing like flame. Dineven thought he heard a terrible intimation of holocaust in the priest's departing footsteps, of a great and final conflagration, a black scorching of the pages of history. Miriam L. was sewing a wooden button onto her cloak when someone rapped on the door. Startled, she slid off the cot and padded to answer, her bare feet chill against the cold floor.
Who is it?
Open the door, Prin. Malachias, please open the door.
She drew the bolt. Kadrach stood in the poorly lit hallway, his sweaty face gleaming in the candlelight. He pushed past her into the small cell and elbowed the door shut so abruptly that Miriam L. felt a breeze as it swept by her nose.
Are you mad? She demanded. You cannot just push in like this.
Please, princess.
Get out, now, lady.
Astonishingly, Kadrach fell to his knees. His normally ruddy face was quite pale.
We must flee the Sankelen Adonitis tonight.
She stared down.
You have gone mad.
Her tone was imperious.
What are you talking about? Have you stolen something? I don't know if I should protect you any longer, and I certainly will not go charging out of—
He cut her off in mid-speech.
No, it is nothing I have done. At least nothing I have done tonight. And the danger is not to me so much as to you. But that danger is very great. We must flee.
For several moments, Miriam L. could not think of a thing to say. Kadrach indeed looked very frightened, a change from his usual veiled expression. He broke the silence at last.
Please, my lady, I know I have been a faithless companion, but I have done some good as well. Please, trust me this once. You are in terrible danger.
Danger from what?
Priorates is here.
She felt a wave of relief wash over her. Kadrach's wild words had frightened her after all.
Idiot! I know that. I spoke to the lector yesterday. I know all about Priorates.
The stocky monk rose to his feet. His jaw was set in a very determined way.
That is one of the most foolish things you have ever said, princess. You know very little about him.
and you should be grateful for that. Grateful!
He reached out and seized her arm.
Stop that! How dare you!
She tried to slap at his face, but Gadarak leaned away from the blow, maintaining his grip. He was surprisingly strong.
Saint Murfa's bones, he hissed. Don't be such a fool, Miriamel.
He leaned toward her, holding her gaze with his own wide eyes. There was, she fleetingly noticed, no smell of wine about him.
If I must treat you like a child, I will, the monk growled.
He pushed her backward until she toppled onto the cot, then stood over her, angry yet fearful.
The lector has declared Priorates and your father excommunicate. Do you know what that means?
Yes, she said, her voice almost a shout. I'm glad.
But Priorates is not glad. And something bad will happen. It will happen very soon. You should not be here when it does.
Bad? What do you mean? Priorates is alone in the Sankelen. He came with half a dozen of my father's guardsmen. What can he do?
And you claim to know all about him.
Gadrach shook his head in disgust, then turned and began scooping Miriamel's loose clothing and few possessions into her traveling bag.
I, for one, he said, do not want to see whatever he will be getting up to.
She watched him for a moment, dumbfounded. Who was this person who looked like Gadrach, but shouted and ordered and grabbed her arm like a river barge bravo?
I will not go anywhere until I talk to Father Denevan, she said at last.
Some of the edge had disappeared from her voice.
Splendid, Gadrach said. Whatever you wish. Just prepare yourself to go. I'm sure that Denevan will agree with me, if we can find him at all.
Reluctantly, she bent to help him.
Just tell me this, she said. Do you swear that we're in danger? And that it's not something you did?
He stopped. For the first time since he had entered the room, Kadrach's odd half-smile appeared. But this one twisted his face into a mask of terrible sorrow.
We have all done things that we regret, Miriamel. I have made mistakes that set God the Highest to weeping on his great throne.
He shook his head, angry at wasting time with talk.
But this danger is real and immediate, and there is nothing we can either of us do to make it less. Thus we shall flee. Cowards always survive.
Seeing his